Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Well, good morning, Susan, on this snowy day. We have a great lineup today here on the show. First of all, we'll be talking with Bill Sherman, who heads the Country Schools Project for Preservation Iowa, and he will give us a background on the one- and two-room schools and what became of them in Iowa. Then we'll talk with Barb McDougall, the teacher in Boone, who is in the middle of restoring Cole School in Boone County. And then we're going to talk to Bob Jensen of Gilbert, whose father attended a school in Franklin Township where no one spoke no English. That's not, but they didn't speak any English. I'm not very good at English. And then we'll talk with two men who attended country schools in Iowa when they were children. We're going to have Sam Wormley and Larry Kearson. We'll end the show today with a feature from the Community Calendar, an interview with Mark Andrew, and he's the director of Webster City Community Theater, and they'll be having a production coming up of Almost Maine. It'll be opening this weekend.
And we're ready right now with Bill Sherman to give us some background on the days when there was a schoolhouse within 2 miles of every child in school age. This is a big story, and Bill is the perfect person to tell us about it. Is Bill on the line?
Yes, I'm here, ready to go.
Okay, wonderful. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
So could you tell us a little about yourself and about the work of Preservation Iowa, trying to preserve those country schools?
I got interested in the whole issue of country schooling in the mid-1990s when I started working on a book project for the Iowa State Education Association. The book was Tributes to Iowa Teachers, and three persons who attended one-room schools wrote tributes to their one-room school teacher. That tricked my curiosity, and I wondered how many country schools were there in Iowa at one time, and I knew there weren't any operating, or I didn't think there were any operating in Iowa. I went to the library and found no information. There were articles that people had written reminiscing about their one-room school experiences, but no really hard data. So I decided to try and do another book to find out how many buildings were standing, and no research, and I concluded I couldn't do that by myself, so we developed a survey and worked to find volunteers in each of Iowa's 99 counties who would do the ground-level research. We asked two basic questions. How many buildings that had been used as one- and two-room schools were still standing in your county, and how were they being used today? And we eventually, after a couple of years, did get results back from each of the counties.
So this is like a census of the one-room schools, is that right?
Yes.
Now, how many were there at the high point, and what was the high point?
Well, in 1901, we had 12,623 operating one- and two-room schools in Iowa, and that's according to data in the biannual report issued by the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. So I consider that the high point. We had started consolidating one-room schools, but Iowa was still growing. The rural areas were still expanding with new farmers coming in. So even though we were consolidating, by that time we still had more new schools coming online that raised the total.
Well, I first became aware of this issue when I was with Paul Wearson, and we were doing an interview with an old farmer who had attended a one-room school. And Paul told me that there was a one-room school within 2 miles of every child in Iowa. Is that right?
Well, it's close to being right. The legislature all actually passed a law saying that these country schools should be located so that no child would have to walk more than 2 miles to get to a school. Of course, we didn't have any form of mass transportation, and roads in many parts of Iowa were impassable, so the only way children could get to school would be to walk. In some counties, we had rivers and rugged terrain, towns and cities, and so we didn't have a school every 2 miles, but we had them located so that no one should have to walk more than 2 miles.
Well, now, when they did start having more, I guess you wouldn't exactly call it consolidation, but there was an issue you mentioned with the state school board, where there was an election for a school board official. Could you tell me that story again so that our listeners could hear it?
Okay, well, it was really a historic election that was held in 1921, and there were three candidates for state superintendent of public instruction that were running for the Republican nomination. And in those days, the Republican Party was the dominant party in Iowa, and so whoever won the Republican nomination would likely be elected to the state office. Three candidates, Mae Francis, P.E. McClanahan, and Mr. Booth. McClanahan and Booth were officials in the State Department of Public Instruction. They both favored further consolidation of country schools. Mae Francis, the woman who at that time was serving as supervisor of rural schools in Iowa, and she would travel about the state of Iowa working with local educators and farmers to try and improve the one-room schools. She understood the economic climate and the decline in income that farmers were facing because of falling commodity prices. The two men, as I said, well, we need to continue to consolidate the one-room schools to ensure that children get an adequate education. Mae Francis said, no, we can't do that because farmers can't afford to pay higher property taxes. And Mae was right. She won the Republican primary and then went on to win the general election as a champion of continuing to improve the one-room school. The other significant factor about that election, Mae became the first woman in Iowa elected to statewide office. She kind of broke the glass ceiling in terms of elected women to statewide office.
Could you give me some idea of how dense this population was, for example, by county, by township?
Well, if we had a perfect grid system in a township, we could have 9 country schools located in a township, spread 2 miles apart, or actually 4 miles apart. So we could have 9 schools in a township. Most Iowa counties had 16 townships, so we could have upwards of 144 country schools located in Iowa. There were a few counties, because of their shape, actually had more than that, and then others had less. In 1901, most counties had more than 100 operating one- and two-room schools.
I understand that a lot of the work now of the Preservation Iowa is in helping people preserve those remaining schools. Do you have any idea of how many of those schools are still in existence? How many have been restored, or those kinds of questions?
Yes, that was part of the statistical analysis of the survey that we asked local county residents to provide. And once we got all the county reports tabulated, we identified almost 3,000 schools that were standing in some form in Iowa in 1998. The most common way that these school buildings were being used was as some type of residence. Over 1,100 of the school's buildings that remained were used as some type of home or residence for people. Today we still have some new school buildings that are being used, being remodeled and turned into some type of home. We also identified more than 1,100 schools were used as some type of farm building or a storage shed, a hay barn, a place to park vehicles, various types of farm buildings. The good thing that was happening is that we had nearly 188 of these school buildings were being restored as some type of museum facility, a building that was put back into the form that it was in when children were attending, equipped with school desks, furniture, readers, and so forth. And because of the work of Preservation Iowa and several other people, we've had an increase in the number of buildings being restored as a museum facility. And now in Iowa, in 2015, we have over 200, I would estimate maybe around 220 schools that are restored as a museum facility, and we have at least one in every county in Iowa. And one of the cases or statements I made after we got all this data compiled was that Iowa should be considered as America's country school capital, in that we have more buildings standing, more schools preserved, and more schools listed on the National Register of Historic Places than any other state in the United States.
That's quite an achievement, and we're going to be spending the rest of the hour talking with people who are either involved in some kind of preservation or have some memories. So I thank you so much for being with us and telling us all these great things, and thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for taking time to discover and report about this issue, and maybe that will encourage some of our other listeners to look at preserving a school building that may be in their area.
Thank you. And I'd like to just mention the ones that I discovered online in our listening area, and I'm sure that there are more, but they are all pretty impressive. The Story City Historical Society has the Sheldahl School, and that's very well developed with the pictures as well as the names of all the teachers. And the Boone County Historical Society has Hickory Grove School. Haley School is north southeast of Nevada, and the Harmony Center School in Wilson Brewer Park in Webster City, and the Hoggett School, run by the Ames History Center, is located on the school grounds of Meeker School. So there are lots of chances for people to visit some of these museums.
For listeners who tuned in late, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we've been speaking with Bill Sherman, who heads the County Schools Project for Preservation Iowa, that helps people interested in restoring the surviving one- or two-room schoolhouses. Next, we'll hear from Barb McDougall about the specifics of Cole School near Boone and how that restoration developed as a school and community project. But first, a little music. Well, we're about to interview Barb McDougall, who's here today. She's here by phone. Barb, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, good morning, Barb.
And good morning.
Happy day to you. You're involved in restoring the Cole Schoolhouse. Tell me what inspired that project for you.
Well, it was back in 2006, and I was going to be installed as regent of our local DAR chapter, Deshaun chapter, here in Boone. And whenever we have a new regent, the regent chooses a chapter project to work on. And the objectives of our society are education, patriotism, and historic preservation. So I had driven by this schoolhouse on my way to work every day, and it was just in a deplorable state, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we worked on preserving that? The mortar was falling out. There were holes in the brick. The cedar shingles had been covered by tin, and that was coming off. All the windows were broken out. So I really thought, if we don't do something, this isn't going to last another year. So I talked to the landowners, Phil and Annette Meyer, and they very much wanted it saved. And so they gave the building and an acre of land to us to restore it.
Well, that's great. Now, money is involved when you're doing a preservation project. How did you pursue money?
Well, first I should tell you, I guess, that our first grant came from the Department of Ed. And the way that happened is about the time I was thinking about doing this project, I talked to the principal at one of our elementary buildings, Dan Gould. And he had just been to a conference and heard someone talk about getting kids involved in historic preservation. And so we kind of put our heads together and thought, well, maybe if the DAR hooks up with the Boone Schools, we could get this accomplished. And so that summer I went to a national conference of the National Country School Association of America in DeKalb, Illinois. And there I met Bill Sherman from Des Moines, who I think you were just interviewing. And he became my mentor, as he has done for so many people who have wanted to restore country schoolhouses. And I found that he hosts every year in October an Iowa Country School Conference. And so I started going to that as well. And actually, this year's conference is going to be hosted in Boone. And the director of our historical museum, Pam Schwartz, has given us a lot of support for the project, too. By hooking up with the Boone Schools, I was able to get a $10,000 service learning grant from the Department of Education to get the kids involved. And so that kind of jump-started the project. And the kids became little entrepreneurs. They made all kinds of crafts to sell. They held bake sales. They sold candy at basketball games. They just did a lot of things to raise money for the project. And the PTO was very supportive. They held a carnival for all the kids with the proceeds going to the restoration project. And then I began writing other grants. And so we've received grants from the State Historical Society. They have a grant specifically for country school preservation. So that has been very helpful. We got grants from Barilla America, from Walmart, Thrivent Lutheran Services, Modern Woodmen of America, the Pratt Fenton Trust, and Country School Association of America.
That's great. Look at all the things you did to be creative to make that happen.
Well, it takes a village, as they say.
Well, I'm so glad you involved children because they have a learning experience and understanding why they're doing this. And, of course, kids, when they sign on to a project, it gets done. Now, Barb, you're a member of DAR, is that right?
That's right.
Is that the Daughters of the American Revolution?
That's correct.
Wow. And they're here in Iowa, too. They're everywhere.
Oh, well, yeah. We have, 52 chapters, 50 chapters, I'm not sure.
Well, now, what's unusual about this building that you have there, the Cole School building? What's special about it?
Well, we think the best thing about it is that it is one of the few brick schoolhouses left in Iowa. And what's really special is that it's constructed of three layers of brick. There's actually two outside layers and then an airspace of 2 or 3 inches and then an inside layer of brick. And so we suspect that that probably was for insulation purposes, and we think that the brick came from Yegi Brickyard here in Boone, which later became the Boone Brick and Tile Company, which was a very important brick company in the Midwest. And
what years was the school in use?
1888 to 1933.
And what have you learned? What have you learned about the builders? Are the people who put it together? Are the teachers? Have you done some research on the families and children and all the
folks?
Yeah,
as far as the builders, we haven't been able to find out exactly who did that. But I did do a lot of research at the library to find out about the teachers and the children and also at the Historical Museum. And we have, when we started the project 9 years ago, we had two gentlemen in town who attended Cole School. One of them was Bill Ross, and he has since passed away. And the other one is Orville Nelson, who still lives in Boone and has been our biggest supporter of the project. And he is just waiting for us to get it finished. So he's very excited about it.
Well, what have you been accomplishing so far? Where are you in the project? You've got some folks working on this. You have a contractor?
Yes. We hired Renaissance Restoration from Galena, Illinois. And we were just amazed that they would take our little brick schoolhouse because they've done some amazing projects around the Midwest. Their specialty is brick restoration. And so far they have repointed all the brick. They've restored the limestone foundation, taken the cement that had been put over it, taken that off. They've placed new windowsills and a door stoop and put windows in. And they actually got period glass from another old building to use. So
that's just terrific.
Authentic.
Now you had a roofing company too, right?
Yes, we hired Pritchard Construction from Ogden, and they put a cedar roof on, cedar shingles. And then our Boone High School construction class, under the direction of Mike Hankey, has done a lot of work out there. They pulled up the old floorboards and repaired the joists. They laid a floor using reclaimed lumber from a barn down the road. And now they've been working on fixing the rafters and installing a new ceiling.
And then
my husband did a lot of the wall repair, fixing the big cracks with mortar and then replastering. And I should mention, too, kind of a fun point, one of our members' husbands, Lloyd Tagason, even built an outhouse for us.
An outhouse. It's indispensable.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, now you're attempting to get the building listed on the National Historic Register. What is involved with that? That's quite a project, too, I think.
Well, we knew from the beginning that we wanted to try for that. And I kind of put it on hold because we were in the middle of the restoration, and that kind of took, you know, most of our time. But this past year, I started working on the application, and I'm hoping that it's going to be accepted soon.
That's pretty involved, I think, to get those any building registered on the National Historic Register.
It is. It takes a lot of research and documentation. And,
yeah. And you're still applying for grants and money, I take it. Is that right, Barb?
Well, I haven't recently, but we have received some other grants besides, I told you about the grants, I guess. And then we also got some donations from some of our local organizations, which was very nice. We got from the American Legion and Kiwanis and Questers, and then a number of individuals have given us donations, so that's very helpful. And we even got some donations of some artifacts already, like a Victrola and a merry-go-round and school desks and
Hey, that's
desks.
Wonderful. Barb, I'm so thrilled about what you're doing here. It's been satisfying for you, I'm sure. Look at all the people that's in the community who've plugged in, particularly children. And this is going to be a great thing when it all gets finished and furnished. Susan, what do you think about this?
Well, I think it's great, but I'd like to know, I've already been asked by our guests, where is this school? How can people find it?
Okay, it's just northeast of Boone on R Avenue. So you can remember R for Red Brick Schoolhouse. So it's 2.5 miles northeast of Boone.
And is it on Old Highway 30?
No, it's on E26 on the north side of Boone.
Okay.
And then you go a quarter of a mile north on Gravel, which is our avenue.
Well, thank you so much. This is, I can hardly wait till it's finished. We can, I guess we could go look at it now, right?
You sure can, and it won't be long. We're hoping to get it finished up this spring and have a big event out there.
Well, we'll be sure to let us know so we can come.
All right. Thank you so much.
So, thanks for telling us about this very interesting school building. We've been listening to Barb McDougall telling us about the Cole School, and we need a little traveling music, or actually, I guess, we need a little ragtime, which Bill Sherman told me is the appropriate music for this era. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've just heard from Barb McDougall about the restoration of the brick Cole School in rural Boone County. Now we have some guests with us in the studio to tell about the experiences of attending school in a one-room schoolhouse. I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts, but my co-host Paul Wearson is the one who really knows about this subject. So I'll turn this over to you, Paul.
Well, this will really be a test of my knowledge, but I want to introduce a friend of mine, actually, Bob Jensen of Gilbert, who he won't tell you, but he's a great actor. I've seen him on stage, but he's not here today as an actor. He's going to be talking about the county schools, the country schools of Franklin Township, and his father, whose parents were Danish immigrants. Welcome to our program, Bob.
Thank you very much for having me. I consider it to be an honor.
Well, it's good to have you here. And just tell us about that school that your father attended.
Well, the school's name was Union, and it was located in Section 15 in Franklin Township. If any of you are familiar with this area, it was directly across the road from what is now the Moose Lodge, what used to be the Oaks Golf Course. My father started a school there in the year 1909. His parents were both Danish immigrants coming over here, my grandfather in 1893, my grandmother in 1899. Neither of my grandparents at that time spoke very much English. And in the home, the only thing that was spoken was Danish. So my father and his brother were sent down the road a half mile where they started attending school without the ability to speak the English language. Consequently, they struggled. I have had in my possession for quite a while the roster of the school kids attending that school, and they had very few children, but for some reason they designated them by number. Their names were listed, so it's easy to determine which number your person was. And my father and his brother, Einar, were evaluated as being rather deficient in the English language. And this was a problem for my father for the rest of his life. He never pronounced his THs quite correctly. If I was to go to the field to cut thistles, it was given to me as an instruction, go cut the thistles today. And we, as eight children, constantly laughed at my father's situation.
Did he talk about how many students were at that school?
There is a picture of my father along with the students that were there, and as it looks to me like there were one dozen, and there were a number of Danish immigrant children. Along Highway 69 at that time, from about 190th Street up to the Gilbert Corner and slightly a little further north, the land was pretty much all owned by Danish immigrants. Now, Gilbert's kind of an unusual community in itself because there are different enclaves strung out through the system. At the north end of Gilbert, there's lots of Norwegians. At the northwest, there's lots of Germans. And it just so happened that the Danes kind of accumulated right along Highway 69. So I'm sure that there were a lot of kids that had the same experiences throughout that particular township. There were nine in Franklin Township because it was a nice square township, and most of those closed up in 1917 and came to Gilbert. Now, there were a few holdouts that decided they wanted to stay in existence for a while. I know the Bloomington School at the old Bloomington Village continued to operate at least into the fairly late 40s. That's pretty much the case. You know, the one-room school experience, to me, I'm a retired teacher, by the way. I taught for 22 years. Now there's a popular term, mentoring, to be used in the school districts now. This is not brand new. This has been going on forever. In the country school experience with kids ranging from first grade through eighth grade, a mentoring was an absolute necessity. That if you wanted enough kids to play ball out at recess time, the big kids had to be good to the little kids or they wouldn't have enough to field a team. So I think there was lots and lots of positive things coming out of the one-room school experience. You also had built into the system a remedial program. If you were a little bit slower and you listened to the lessons of the younger kids, you picked up stuff you missed the first time around. If you were academically capable and you were a first grader or a second grader, you might already learn your multiplication tables because you're listening to the fourth, fifth graders doing their lessons. So there was a lot of positives about this situation. The breadth of the curriculum and things like that was probably a detriment, but there are certainly a lot of things that were really, really positive.
You know, that was, Bob, that's very informative. When you place it in that context, all the kids helping one another, and review happens for the older kids when they teach the younger kids, is there's a flavor of we're all in this together. And when you talk about your father and the Danish immigrants who were learning English as a second language, that echoes into today. If you went to Marshalltown or populations in Iowa where there is quite a representation of immigrants, these are kids who are doing the same thing your grandfather did. So there's nothing new under the sun, and we are all and were and are immigrants.
That's for sure. It's, you know, I had one other experience, and I didn't go to a one-room schoolhouse because Gilbert was, quote, progressive, where they had consolidated in 1917 for the most part. But I started a school in the fall of 1948. Now, we're talking about 3 years after the end of the war.
That was the year I went. That's, oh, yeah. It was a good year.
It was 3 years after the end of World War II, and there were millions of displaced people in Europe. And I'll never forget, halfway through our first grade year, a little girl came into our classroom who had woolen socks clear up past her knees and a very colorful skirt and sweater and things of this nature that was pretty foreign to most of the kids in our class. And I remember her coming in and the look of consternation on her face because she could not speak one word of English. And she started to cry, and she was only there for 2 days. And they must have decided that they were going to move her to another less traumatic place to go to school. At that point, even at that age, you know, I could identify with her and listening to my father's experiences and think how she must have felt to have had come into that type of environment.
That's a great story. And just imagine how she felt. And Susan, we have two other guests in the studio here that you can introduce for us.
Yes, thank you for sharing all that you know about these schools. And actually, we now have two people who experienced those mentoring situations. And now the other two that we have are two friends of mine, Sam Wormley and Larry Kirschen.
Good to be with you this morning.
When did you go to the country schools?
Well, I started in 1942. That would have been when I was in kindergarten. I went to a country school near Walnut, Iowa, southwestern Iowa, Pottawatomie County. I went there for my entire grade school career up until the eighth grade. In eighth grade, I went to town school, but kindergarten through seventh grade, I went to the country school. I might add that I had the same teacher for the first seven of those 8 years until I was in the seventh grade. I got a different teacher, but I had the same teacher for the first years of that experience.
Let's also bring in Sam for your comparison.
In 1948, when I was just 4 years old, there was a big fire in our farm community, and it was the schoolhouse, and it burnt down. During that coming school year, the students were in a chicken house with a wood stove, fire heater, and the building was rebuilt during that year. And so when I started kindergarten in 1949, I got to be in this brand new building. It was a one-room schoolhouse, and there were outhouses outside. But in the second year, there were outhouses inside. They were still that kind of toilet, but you went in the doorway and you went to the left and that was the girls and you went to the right and that was the boys. I look back at it very fondly. One wall was all bookshelves and it was a library. We had windows on two sides. There was a coal furnace in the basement and the older kids would be the ones responsible for shoveling in coal and cobs and so on to heat in the wintertime. And so I was there from kindergarten through the eighth grade. And when I finished eighth grade, that school closed down. It was called Newton Number 6. It was also called Hammer School because the farm land that was donated for the school was from the family named Hammer. And when we went to town school in Newton, in this case, Newton, Iowa, all the country kids seemed to have a better education than the town school kids. And so they had a leg up when we started mixing and competing with each other. But it was good. I remember one more thing. In that library, we had a collection of National Geographic magazines. And no, I wasn't hunting for the naked pictures, but I did find a picture of Kepler's nested spheres, and that just amazed me. Sir Johannes Kepler was back in the early 1600s and had this idea that all of the planets and the sun and everything were geometrically related and had this model, and I saw that, and I've been fascinated all my life from that.
Your reminiscences should probably trigger some for Larry. What was your school like?
Well, it was a one-room frame schoolhouse. It was located about three-quarters of a mile from the farm home where I grew up. We walked to school every day, but that was really no big deal. You know, being on the farm, you were used to being outside basically from the time you got up in the morning until you came in the evening. So you were out, you were walking around. So you walk to school, well, that's no big deal. We just do that anyway. The weather was not a factor. You'd walk to school when it was warm or when it was cold. There's been a lot of talk recently about bread bags on your shoes, and I never saw anyone in my school wearing bread bags on their feet, but a lot of kids would wear five-buckle overshoes, and, when it rained in the spring, the road was not paved, was not graveled. It was pretty much like a cornfield, and that would be the tough walk right after a rainstorm. So,
well, I have one more question, and it really is for any of you, because somebody told me about school buses that took kids to country schools. I believe that was you, Bob. Could you tell us?
Well, I don't know that there were ever school buses taking kids to the country schools. In our particular case, in the school that I went all the way through, Gilbert, when they consolidated and they most of the nine country schools in Franklin Township went to Gilbert, then they had to buy buses to transport the kids to school. At one time, there were nine horse-drawn school buses to bring the kids to school, and quite a number of them were driven by the high school students. In one case in our community, the horse-drawn school bus was driven by an eighth-grade girl, and she was quite the pioneer-spirited gal, and she lived to be close to 100, and one of my classmates was her daughter. So it was quite an interesting experience.
This is amazing. I think of today's helicopter parents understanding all these risks that were taken by kids who really lived to be older. So maybe we ought to give our kids a little more slack in taking some risks. She's driving the school. Well, my brother was a high school senior and driving a regular school bus. He was class of 1945. And so they actually let a senior do this, you know. And, of course, today the litigation possibilities would just make you cringe, you know, when you talk about that. So we do indeed live in a different world. But, you know, what you fellows have described today is a time that really calls up not only the country life, but also the way everyone worked together and pulled together and the kind of democratic way that kids related to each other in a one-room school. There weren't the divisions now between the grades that were so distinct. And everyone was in it together, and there's a lot to be said about that. And I really think, Sam, that you pointed out something great when you got to the public school in Newton, that you folks felt that you had an edge, that you had been well-educated. And then we all have those great moments like you had with Kepler, where we have an educational breakthrough or serendipity experience that makes us feel like, yeah, it's fun to go to school.
There was one detriment for kids that came out of country schools, depending upon your psychological makeup, I guess. My mother related that when she left a country school and went to Clinton High School, she didn't feel socially accepted. And that was a little bit of a drawback of leaving the eighth grade education and then pursuing going on. I don't know that that's ever going to change. That happens with people. It appears to be somewhat the human situation.
That's true. We country school kids were outsiders when we merged in with the larger school.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, it's just it goes down to fundamental human behavior. Whoever is unfamiliar or different from us is suspect. And then that has to be dealt with somehow. So you depended on your personality and your ability to adjust to make that transition. Hey, guys, it's been fun today. Susan, hasn't been fun?
Sure has. And we've had a great time in the country schools. And now we're going to go to Webster City and find out about a little entertainment for the weekend. Thank you so much to all of you. This has been KHOI Community Radio, and our live guests for this portion of Country Schools have been Bob Jensen and Sam Wormley and Larry Kearson. And we're moving on to talk to Mark Andrew, the director of
Almost Maine.
This is KHOI Community Radio, where co-hosts Paul Wearson and Susan Franson have been talking with people who are trying to preserve the remaining old one- and two-room school buildings, as well as those who have memories of attending one of these schools. We'll close our today's show celebrating Valentine's Day by production of the play Almost Maine, and we'll be talking with the director, Mark Andrew. Hi, Mark. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Mark is involved with Webster City Community Theater, and I'm hearing good things about what's going on in Webster City. And this show is a new one to me, so could you tell us what that show's about?
Well, Almost Maine, Almost Comma Maine, is a play written by John Carini, and it is a series of vignettes, are really independent. There are no recurring characters scene to scene, but they all have in common that they happen the same night, approximately 9 o'clock, midwinter, kind of about right now, and they happen at the time of the Northern Lights in the town of Almost Maine.
This is a series of short stories, vignettes, if you will, that are all independent with no recurring character, and they all happen at about the same time, approximately 9 o'clock p.m., all on midwinter's evening at the time of the Northern Lights in Almost, Maine.
Well, now tell me about, you have a new theater up there, is that right, Mark?
Well, no, the Webster City Community Theater actually in the current building has been around for 25 years in that.
Describe the theater that you have there. How intimate is that? Can you do theater in the round, and how many seats are there, and
not a theater in the round. It's an open stage and has approximately 145 seats. New seats were put in the last year or so, along with an addition on the west end of the building.
So now, this show, how large is the cast?
If you look at the book, the playbook, it talks about either doing this play with four characters, four actors, or 19. The idea being that these are all in the, each scene typically has two people in it, and it's 6 to 8 pages of steady dialogue between those two people, and then they're done. I mean, that's their only time on stage. So it created a lot of very unique opportunities for casting and directing compared to your usual full participation, ongoing characters on screen for any given play.
Well, now tell me about the opening night. When's opening night for you?
Opening night is this Friday night. Our production, the next two weekends, Friday and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Well, that's going to be fun, and that will be at the Webster City Community Theater. Now, are you involved with all the plays, Mark?
Not all of them. Kind of selectively, depending on what the production is.
So you have several folks up there who are involved in direction for the plays, is that correct?
And actually, this play, we have a total of 6 directors.
Wow.
I'm the, if you will, the executive or coordinating director. I direct several of the scenes. But we looked at this as an opportunity to allow some folks that maybe weren't typically involved with directing, that might have an interest in directing, a chance to get their feet wet. And so we've got Louine Getter, Doug Getter, Al Youngquist, Stephanie Hill, and Angela Roderick all are directing a scene in this play. When I looked at this play, really liked it, thought it gave us a lot of unique opportunities, and from a casting standpoint as well, because sometimes, especially in these midwinter shows, folks are maybe not as available to do a full-fledged production 3 nights a week and very intense 6 to 8 week preparation for the production, whereas this one allowed a lot of flexibility between the director for that scene and the two actors or actresses for that given scene to practice at their own schedules, if you will. We actually only brought the whole cast together to kind of string it together, work on scene transition, music, lighting, and stuff last week. So it's just these last 2 weeks that we've actually fully pulled everybody together. But there's a lot of flexibility and allowed some people to really get involved with this who maybe hadn't been typically involved in the past.
Well, I've done theater before, and this sounds like a very unique method of producing a play and a very unique format. If you wanted, now this is being produced actually during Valentine's month. Is there a theme that relates to that time of the year?
All these various scenes deal with some aspect of the heart. Most of the time it's good. Some of the time it's a little more sad, but it certainly gives you a lot of different looks at romance and budding romance and the end of romance. So it is very pertinent to this time of the year heading into the final weekend of production, which will cover the Valentine's Day weekend.
Well, now, this has been a lot of fun, Mark. I think that you've got something that's unique. It sounds like it's been challenging to produce, and it sounds like you're happy with your cast, too. It's been fun. Is that right?
Yeah, the interesting thing to me is the idea of having these things out there that I typically did not see until we got it all together and bringing it in. But I was extremely pleased that everybody's put in a lot of hard work and really has done just an excellent job in bringing their scene to life and really communicating the message of the play.
Well, having been in community theater, the experience of doing production and rehearsing for a play creates sort of a pseudo-family. And so when you have opening night and you have your run, there's sort of a bittersweet moment, and Bob Jensen's here with me. He can relate to that, too, where you're glad the production's done and you feel this tremendous sense of satisfaction. And then this family breaks up, right, Bob? It's just terrible.
Absolutely. You have this feeling of letdown.
Right.
The pressure's off, but the camaraderie is temporarily suspended until the next time around when you go at it again.
And that's what keeps us going at it. It's a form of addiction. And hey, it's really been great to have you here today, Mark, and good luck. And I'm just going to remind everybody that opening night, this Friday, February 6th at 7:30 p.m., it'll be at the Webster City Community Theater. It will also be performed at 7:30 p.m. on 7th February, the 13th and 14th, and 2 p.m. on Sunday, February 8th and 15th. Thank you for being with us.
Could I maybe give folks a phone number to call if they were interested?
Yeah, go ahead. Shout it loud and clear.
The number for the box office is 515-832-4456.
Thank you very much, Mark, and break a leg. Is that what they say?
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to come on and tell people about our play.
Thanks, Mark.
Let's have a little more ragtime.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been talking about country schools today. First, the buildings and the people working to preserve a few of them for us, and then firsthand memories of attending school in them.
We wrapped up the program today by previewing Almost Maine, a series of romantic vignettes, which will play at the Webster City Community Theater this coming weekend, and the Valentine weekend to follow. Our guests today have been Bill Sherman, Barb McDougall, Bob Jensen, Sam Warmley, Larry Kearson, and Mark Andrew. Your hosts have been Paul Wearson and Susan Franson, and the show was engineered by Rebecca Brown.
Music you heard was Topsy Turvy Two-Step by Louise V. Gustin, Fizzles by Two Step by Kate Meyer Smith, and The Gravel Rag by Charlotte Blake, as well as Honeybee. All performed by Nora Hulse, piano, from the CD Cakewalks, Two Steps, and Rags by Women Composers, 1899 to 1920. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Now, you can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, where we are streaming live. You'll also find recent shows on our homepage with links to the organizations and other resources that have been mentioned in all our Local Talk shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget. We'd also like to hear feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line. Or stop in at the KHOI studios at 410 Douglas in Ames.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Your participation as audience are what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and
see you again on the radio.